Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfhorn. There are a lot of reasons to spend time outdoors. Fun would be high on my list, but there are deeper reasons too. On today's show, we're going to talk about how time spent outdoors and in nature can develop us as people, the personal growth part of exploration. Adrienne Lindholm has written a book about her journey from mountain newbie trying to prove herself with big challenges to becoming a mom who's more interested in the journey. We'll also have a segment with Carrie Carpenter. She's campaigning for longer recess for Anchorage school children, and she'll also talk about how outdoor adventures helped her cope with breast cancer. And finally, we'll have a segment on race with an urban resident who enjoys time in nature and asks why minorities are less common in wild places. The show today has a lot of insights for me when I was making it, and I think you'll find it interesting too. Please stay tuned. Well, I'm really excited to have an author in the studio with me. Adrienne Lindholm is the author of It Happened Like This, A Life in Alaska, which is a new book out from Mountaineers Books. And this is a unique book because it's about becoming an Alaskan and doing the outdoor things that I know our listeners do, because we talk about them all the time. And the place names are going to be familiar to our listeners. It's all about, you know, being in the Chugach and being in the Talkeetna Mountains and the adventures you can have there. But Adrienne has taken those stories and put them together in a series of chapters, which are really about her growth as a young person coming to Alaska and then becoming an Alaskan and a pretty accomplished outdoors person. So really excited to have Adrienne Lindholm here today to talk about the book. Thanks for being here, Adrienne.
Thanks for having me, Charles.
So this is a story of growth, I think. I mean, it's a story of your development as a person. And I think what's interesting about it is not just the adventures, but the way that they affect you and the way you respond to the outdoors and as you're maturing through the course of the book. And I guess when I think about writing it, I wonder, is that where you thought you were going when you started working on this?
Well, actually, I started writing this many, many years ago and originally wrote it as a collection of essays to chronicle my time kind of falling in love with mountains and coming to Alaska and all these new things I was experiencing. And I actually wrote a collection of essays. And when I sent those out to publishers, I got several responses back that said, nobody reads collections of essays anymore. And I was heartbroken because I love essays, mm-hmm. but apparently not many people
do. And there have been some great books that have been collections of essays.
Right. And they said, you know, this really needs to be a narrative with a story arc. And so I went back and restructured the whole thing. And when I started piecing them together, I realized that there was this kind of clear path of growth. So it really is a coming of age story set in this kind of Alaska wilderness backdrop.
Yeah. And I think that one of the things you do very effectively that is unusual and that I've never read before is talk about showing up here and really not knowing what you're doing. But, and this is something I thought only guys did, but not wanting people not to know what you're doing. So you talk about walking around the REI and not wanting to ask like where something is because you feel like I'm an outdoors person. I should already know where these things are, which
right.
is hilarious, but also very identifiable.
Oh, that's funny. Yes, I have really cringe at some of those memories of myself. And I think sometimes, especially when we're in our 20s and we have the whole world before us and we want to make a big splash and a big impression, it's pretty unnerving to feel like you don't know anything. And so as a new person showing up to Alaska in my 20s, this wide-eyed, naive girl, and I held people who were skilled at being in mountains and being in wilderness sort of up on a pedestal and so badly wanted to learn and but didn't really want to admit that I didn't know what I was doing. So I did, in fact, walk around REI not wanting to ask where, you know, the iodine tablets were.
Yeah. Well, and you have this list that you talk about writing on the plane to Alaska. Is that true? You really wrote it on the plane to Alaska?
I really did have a list. I really did have a notebook, actually.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Because it's hilarious.
It is. Yeah.
It's so, you know, spirituality. Is that a new age term for religion, you know? And then this one that Nancy Lord mentioned in her review of the book, killing, including hunting, is barbaric and wrong. And so this forms like a starting point. You're putting a stake in the ground and saying, this is where I came from, and now we're going to see how I changed, right?
Exactly.
Did you keep these notebooks and be able to look back and think, oh my gosh, that's who I was, you know?
Yeah, I do continue to journal, and I am really glad I wrote all those things when I was in my teens and my 20s, if for nothing else to look back and laugh at myself. I do consider this book, I've been calling it my experiment in vulnerability, because it is, while it's exciting to have a book out there, it's equally horrifying to, you know, have exposed those very intimate details of my life, including those kind of journals from the naive girl who I was in my early 20s. So,
Well, as I was reading the intro and the acknowledgments, I was thinking about that vulnerability. But when I read the book, I was surprised, because what we're used to in memoir these days is people kind of laying it all out and laying, you know, sort of embarrassing, you know, sexual or other details. And you don't do that. Actually, what you lay out there is, in a way, it's much more embarrassing, which is kind of being dumb, right? And kind of being naive, and sort of, and if you weren't able to do that, you would have no story, right? Because it's a story of becoming more sophisticated and sort of putting things in perspective in Alaska. But I found that to be unique and wonderful in a way, because you were able to sort of show yourself as you were in those days.
Right. Yeah, the book really is kind of about being inside my head and kind of exposing those, my thought process moving through life.
And you don't even use the last names of people. And some of them, I think I know who they are, but you kind of keep everybody pretty confidential other than yourself.
Yeah, you know, actually, I never wanted to write about myself. In fact, all of my early essays were all about the place. And some of my earlier reviewers said, you can't just write about a place. You actually have to put yourself in the story. And I resisted that so much, because I tend to be a private person, which you wouldn't really know after reading this book. That's very personal. But I am. And that was so difficult to do. And I realized that they were right, that you do actually need to put yourself in the stories. And so that was a big leap. But then to need other characters and have to put the people around me in the story was another big leap. And I was never entirely comfortable with that. So my friends were kind of these unwilling, unknowing accomplices in this experiment in vulnerability. And I wanted to try to protect their identities as well. And but I did need some other characters.
Yeah, but I didn't feel like you showed anybody in a negative light. You know,
right.
I felt you were pretty kind to everyone. I mean, the thing that I wanted to check in with you on was this aspect of being outdoors and trying to prove something. And some of the anecdotes that you tell, I'm kind of cringing, because I'm thinking, okay, she's doing this stuff for the wrong reasons. She's trying to put a feather in her cap and have people, you know, improve her self-image by having other people see these things she's done. And she's doing stuff that it's dangerous, that she should not be doing for that reason, right? Do when you look back at those stories, do you see it? And I'm thinking particularly of, you're in a wilderness race, it's dark, you're ready to jump in your pack raft and go down a dangerous river. You and your companion are both saying, I'm scared, I don't want to do this. But then you say, well, we're ahead, we got to do it. And then at the last moment, somebody comes up and says, there was an accident, you can't go.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think escaping a lot of those years without major accident or injury was a lot of luck was involved with that, for sure. But, you know, I think we go into the backcountry, we put ourselves in those situations for a number of different reasons. And mm-hmm. those reasons can change. They certainly did throughout my life. And back then, one of the most important purposes that those experiences served for me was creating a sense of identity for myself and self-esteem. And so those experiences, those challenges, you know, knowing that I could go out there and get through it, you know, and suffer and still be okay and show up for myself and show up for my friends, that was absolutely life-altering. Mm-hmm. And it served a really important role for me.
Yeah. Well, I guess everybody has that happening for them when they're in their 20s. It seems to me, and like you disagree with me if you don't think this is true, but it's a bigger issue for women in a way, because for whatever reason, our culture gets women started in the world thinking that they're inadequate or thinking that they can't do things. And we're all sort of, everyone who has a daughter is now thinking about how do we prevent that? You know, how do we make them feel stronger? And that really seems to have been the case for you, even though you talk about what a fabulous parents you had and how supportive they were and how great life was at home. You know, you're a mom now. How do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure there are many books written on that subject. Yeah. But for me, I felt like it was pretty common among all my peers in my 20s of women just sort of seeking to be accepted, seeking some way to prove ourselves and kind of set a stake in the world. And having something like the outdoors to give us a certain level of confidence, I think, was a really wonderful thing for me. It could mm-hmm. come from a number of different things, but that was my experience.
Yeah. And it's sort of proving yourself to yourself and to others at the same time.
Right, right. And then being able to meet other women here who were interested in doing the same things. Mm-hmm. I think we fed off of each other. We kind of gave each other that support and that confidence to keep at it, to actually refine the skills so we knew a little bit more about what mm-hmm. we were doing mm-hmm. to be able to go out there more confidently and comfortably.
Yeah, and yeah. Cool. Adrienne Lindholm is my guest on Outdoor Explorer. She's the author of It Happened Like This, A Life in Alaska, new book out from Mountaineers Books, which is her memoir of developing as a really, really accomplished outdoors woman in South Central Alaska. And my name is Charles Holforth. So how did you gather the knowledge that you needed? Because when you first started, as we've said, you were not that comfortable about asking, right?
Right.
Did you have to get over that hump? Because the reason I think this is important is, I mean, we have listeners who they're thinking, I want to do some of that stuff. How do I do it? And I also don't, you know, and they also are thinking, I can't ask. And I remember learning all kinds of stuff and having to ask. And I also learned a lot of trial and error. And I'm curious as to how you got to where you were a learner.
Sure. A lot of trial and error for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, when I came here in 2000, the various clubs would put on lots of classes. So, you know, the Mountaineering Club, and we learned, you know, avalanche skills, and just by taking some classes.
You got serious about it.
Yeah, to get serious about it. I had the advantage of actually coming up here for a job that was in Denali National Park. Mm-hmm. And so I have to attribute a lot of my skill building to the experiences that I had working as a backcountry ranger in Denali. So mm-hmm. even though I showed up there with very little experience, I got to work with people who had a lot of experience.
And this guy, backcountry ranger Jeff, that you're paired up with, who's very taciturn and you're kind of scared of him. Right. Did you learn from him by watching? Did he turn it into a teacher?
I learned from everyone on the ranger staff mm-hmm. there. Absolutely.
Yeah. I enjoyed the anecdote you told too about your first backpacking trip where you brought canned food and forgot the can opener. Because I'm not the only person who's ever done that. Thank goodness.
It's good to know there's someone else.
Incidentally, we also forgot silverware, and this is when I was a teenager. And so you're like trying to heat something up in a can and then sort of eat it directly out of the can. I was like, how dumb am I? Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And on that same trip, I brought a Thermarest and didn't know I was supposed to blow it up. And
yeah, that's
I'm not
hilarious.
Sure what I was thinking. So at least it's given me some empathy for other people who are starting out.
So when you go out on a trip now and think about why you're on the trip and, you know, I know you have young ones, so you can't do quite the gnarly stuff, but that hasn't been for too long. And you're enduring hardship. When you think about, like, why am I doing this, how does that compare to what you would have thought when you were first starting?
Yeah. I still seek a certain level of adventure, although with two small children right now, I don't get out as much as I used to, and I'm totally comfortable with that. I stay closer to home, and I remember before thinking, oh, if I go for a hike in the Eagle River area where I live, it doesn't count because it's not something big enough. Mm-hmm. And now it's my favorite place to go. So just getting to know more intimately a certain landscape that has huge appeal to me, mm-hmm. and to be able to share those experiences with small children and to just experience that wonder of being able to pick a blueberry and just relish in that moment, mm-hmm. of eating off of the land or, you know, seeing a moose walk by, has been really transformative for me. It's made me slow down and actually be able to be in the present moment a little bit better. Mm-hmm. When I do seek out a bigger experience, a kind of a longer trip, I have to say I do gravitate towards the Arctic because there's something about that place that has a certain energy to me that allows me to feel connected to something much larger. And I think maybe that's just the type of experience that I need most in my life right now.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, when you talk about it doesn't count, like you had the sense that it doesn't count. Talk about like what that meant to you then and what it means to you now.
Yeah, back then I sought out kind of longer, high mileage days, 10, 12 hour ridge walks in the Chugach.
But I mean, what does counting mean?
And counting meant that I had accomplished something. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of a measure of success. And the success meant big days, long days, hard days.
You're going to test yourself and you need a challenging test.
It was a testing ground. Absolutely.
And you feel like now you're done testing.
Yeah. I don't feel like I need to prove anything anymore. Uh-huh. Thankfully. Yeah. Yeah. It served its purpose. Uh-huh. And now it serves a totally different purpose.
Well, I totally identify with what you're talking about getting to know a particular place better after you've done sort of the long trips and you've done the trips like, at a certain age, I think, at least for me, realize in one small place, there's an infinite amount of things to discover. As the seasons change, every year is different. Right. There are a million little crevices to learn about, and it becomes super rewarding to be narrow.
Yes, absolutely. I can identify with that.
Mm-hmm. Which also relates to raising children, because once you've got kids there, mm-hmm. then you've got a whole additional set of eyes to see the world with.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, absolutely. It's a spectacular experience being able to do that with small children. And I feel like my backcountry experiences have taught me so much. They've been sort of a training for life out of the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And all those sleepless nights of raising small children and those tests, I honestly feel the endurance that I have for that has largely been because of the experiences in the wilderness, the degree to which you can suffer has translated well into parenting. I think there's nothing harder than raising small children.
Wait till you're raising teenagers.
Right.
Actually, small children, that's easy.
Oh, my goodness. All right.
Once again, I'm talking to Adrienne Lindholm, author of It Happened Like This, A Life in Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth. The show is Outdoor Explorer. So one of the other aspects of your book that I found interesting was when you met your husband, JT, who has been on our show. We were talking about the 12 Peak Challenge, which is this unbelievable one-day climb of 12 mountains in the Chugach, which is incredible. Anybody can do it, and that they do it in such a short amount of time. So he's an extraordinary outdoors person. I'm reading the book and I'm thinking, wow, these women do stuff that I would never be able to do. They are so awesome. They're such hard-ass outdoors people. But then you start going out with him and his friends and they kind of kick your ass, don't they?
They do. Yeah. That was really hard to digest, you know. So we had just, me and my girlfriends had been cultivating this sense of confidence and identity. And then to start dating men whose fitness level was higher, their ability to handle risk was so much higher, it was easy to shatter my world. And I remember having a lot of difficult outings with JT when we were dating, feeling like, I'm so bummed that I can't keep up. And, you know, I thought I was good at this.
Yeah.
And now I feel like I'm not. And I remember sharing some of those feelings with him. And I distinctly remember him literally stopping in his tracks and rolling his eyes. And he said, oh, you too. I've heard this before. Uh-huh. And I'm sure like most guys like that, you know, dating a series of athletic, strong, confident women, they had heard that before. And so it was, I think, pretty common.
Mm-hmm. How did that affect you in terms of your view of yourself? Did you come to peace with it in some level?
I had to at some point. Yeah, I think initially it was my sense of self being so tightly linked to achievements in the mountains, to know that I wasn't that good was sort of a setback. But after a while, I had to recognize that there was more to me than that, and that I could simultaneously appreciate his ability and his interests and retain my own level of confidence and pleasure with being in the outdoors. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to reconcile that. And
part of it is just physically sort of the average man is going to have more upper body strength and more just general strength to do some of these things, maybe not more endurance, but just if you're going up straight up a mountain carrying a heavy load, the sort of people who are at the same level, different genders, are going to have different abilities. And so that's something that you just have to accept.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And it doesn't reflect how good of a person you are, you know?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Right. And the other part about it that I had not really thought about was when you talk about the risk aspect of it. And you talk about this climb going up towards a cornice with JT and some other men where you're thinking like, this is too dangerous. I don't want to be doing this. And they're sort of saying, no, it's fine. We'll just go up and you know, knock a hole in it and go through it. Mm-hmm. Cornice is where snow has curled over the top of a mountain. So it's actually hanging over you. And without going into too much detail, I was thinking the same thing. I was with you. This is too dangerous. I wouldn't do that. You know, but talk a little bit, but you're not criticizing them. You're not saying they were wrong. You're saying that they have different ways of dealing with risk, different maybe risk assessment, and maybe different levels of risk that they could take on.
Yeah, it's hard to make a generalization, you know, about men and women and level of risk. But my experience has been that with a lot of the men in my life who really are operating at this extremely high level of outdoor adventuring.
Which means that they really know what the heck they're doing.
They do. Yeah. And they're lucky and they're strong and they do take some risks that I wasn't as comfortable taking. And it was, the dynamic is really interesting on those types of outings where I think in general, most women would assume a slightly lower level of risk, but not all the time. And in those cases, no, I didn't judge the men for that. That was their experience and kind of their comfort level. And, you know, my comfort level with risk is probably quite a lot higher than a lot of other people.
Not higher than mine. But which is what makes it interesting, because you're already operating at a very high level. And then you find out these other guys are, you know, prepared to accept even more risk. And thinking about, like, if that's about gender in some way, like, why is it about gender? Is it, where does that come from? And, you know, you could think of all kinds of different theories, but I mean, you and JT have been together for a long time now. What's your theory?
Yeah. I think our goals, and I don't want to say that my experience has been that some men are more goal oriented. I think the goal is just often different. And so, for example, for him, a goal is to get to the top of a peak, and he's willing to take a lot of risk to do that. Whereas my goal might be to enjoy the day. And I have the intention of getting to the top of the peak. But if it's feeling like it's just not that much fun anymore, I am totally willing to change the plan. So I think the goal is just a little bit different sometimes.
So I hear a little bit of the 20-year-old Adrian there is get to the top of the peak, right? And so in a sense that your maturing process has pulled you back from that risk into like being prepared to accept less risk, because you're realizing, well, getting to the top of the peak maybe is not that important.
It's not as important to me anymore at all. Yeah, and I'm much more, I guess, risk averse at this point in my life. I think having children has changed that quite a bit for me, and just having different interests. So, yeah.
And do you think that through experience you calculate risk more accurately than you did when you were younger? I've often felt that. Like, when I look back on things that I've done and thought, wow, I wouldn't do that now. That was not a very good idea. It was really, I did it in ignorance and maybe brashness.
Right, absolutely. I mean, especially in the winter, you know, there's no real good way to predict avalanche conditions as much as we'd like to think. So I think that's inherently risky. And I know I took a lot more of those types of risks when I was younger. And it always makes me nervous backcountry skiing now. I still do it, but I don't do it as much.
Yeah, and now you're a mom, so that adds a lot of responsibility.
It does.
You need to come back.
I need to come back.
Yeah. So let's talk about that for a minute. You've got a new baby.
I do.
Just on the scene. And you've also got a 2-year-old?
Yes.
Both girls?
So the 2-year-old, her name is Zoe, and we adopted her from Honduras, and then we have a new baby who we just brought home from Arizona this week.
And we're pre-recording by about a month, so 6 weeks ago. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And his name is Miles. So we have a boy and a girl.
So how do you talk a little bit about going out with a kiddo in this book, and I guess you've got a lot more experience with that now. I recall having people sort of say, you shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't be doing this with babies on my back. My kids all survived. They're all adults now. How do you integrate kids into what you're doing?
JT has really been amazing at being up for almost anything with kids. And mm-hmm. thankfully, he is strong enough to carry huge loads. And we have just incredible, inspiring other parents in our community who've blazed the way, showing us that it is possible to still get out there with kids. And I think that's pretty unique in our country. I think when people hear about what the Alaska parents are mm-hmm. doing, they're astounded that yeah. life and outdoor adventure doesn't end when you have a family. So we've been going backpacking quite a bit and bike camping and even some very mellow lake pack rafting and class one river pack rafting and rafting uh-huh. with kids. So
I think it's actually easier when they're babies because they're portable yeah. and they love it, right? I mean, if you're in a tent and your babies are crawling around, they couldn't be happier because you're basically gotten down on their level.
Unfortunately, that's true. They couldn't be happier, which means they don't sleep at all.
Yeah, so right. Especially in Alaska in the summertime. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about writing your book and bringing it out to the world. You've sort of started doing talks, and you're going to be presenting around town. What could people expect? Where could they find you?
Yeah, so I'll be at the Red Chair Cafe downtown Anchorage on November 2nd. That's going to be the big book launch celebration for this. And it's going to be at 5:30 at the Red Chair Cafe. I'll be giving a presentation and we'll have some food and things like that for folks.
Okay.
So that's the big one for this fall.
And just talking about what's in the book, showing slides?
At that event, I probably won't show slides, uh-huh. but I do have a slideshow. So I'm sure there'll be some other events around town where I'll be doing that as well.
Great. Yeah. Well, it's people should check it out. I enjoyed it. It's It Happened Like This, A Life in Alaska by Adrian Lindholm. Publisher is Mountaineers Books. Thanks for being here, Adrian.
Thank you very much for having me.
Please stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and my next guest is Carrie Carpenter, who I wrote about in my column in Anchorage Daily News. She's a mom at Sand Lake Elementary who is unhappy about the amount of time her kids are getting outside on recess and has turned that into a cause. And we got in touch because I had an email that came across my computer from Great Alaska Schools Anchorage, which was talking about that issue, and it's one that I've cared about a lot, getting kids outdoors, and I think it's really important for kids to develop into adults and just to be happy and healthy kids. But then after meeting Carrie, I found out that she's also got some other interesting stuff she's done. She's a founder of Anchorage Young Cancer Coalition, which is a group of people who have had cancer and have had to deal with that at a much younger age than most of us have seen, and they use the outdoors as well for therapeutically as they support one another. So lots to talk about on our theme of personal development in the outdoors today. Thanks for being here, Carrie.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So tell me again how you kind of got into this the recess issue. It sounds like it happened sort of like naturally.
Yeah, it did. So it started with last year when my kids and I were driving to school. We were listening to a science podcast, and the podcast was talking about how important recess is for kids' learning and growth. And then my kids went to school, and it was the very first day. And when they came home, they said, "Oh my gosh, Mom, you're never going to believe what happened. Today, our recess was shorter. It was cut." And I said, "Oh my gosh, really?" And so sure enough, they had a 60-minute block where they would have 30 minutes for lunch and 30 minutes for recess. And the principal, who was new at the school, had decided to change things up. And so he made it shorter. And so that's how I got into the recess business. I then kind of jumped in talking to him to find out if we could change that and why. He made it shorter, and then kind of went up the chain from there and started working with the Anchorage School District and the school board on this issue.
And when we talk about 45 minutes, that's from when class ends to when it starts again. And in that is the time to get your food, sit down, eat your food, clean up your food, get into your outdoor gear, get outside, come back inside, take off your outdoor gear. So the actual outdoor time could be 20 minutes, 15 minutes?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I think it's an issue not just with recess, but also with the kids' nutrition and what they're eating. You know, like you said, kids, my kids bring their lunch to school, so luckily they can just sit down right away when they get in the room and start eating. But if kids have to stand in line to get their lunch, then that takes another 5 or 10 minutes away from them. So, and kids are not adults. They don't eat as fast as we do. It takes them longer to chew and all of that. It takes them longer to do everything. So, getting on their snow clothes and everything.
Right. So when my kids were young, we had a skating program where we had a few volunteers come in and help get little kids get skates on and go out and skate during recess. And if you put skates on kids, you know that that is a time-consuming process. And if you're trying to do it for like 40 kids, it's a very time-consuming process. I think we must have had more time for recess, because otherwise we would just be getting the skates on by the time they had to come inside.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So what do your kids say about what they can, how it affects them to have that shorter time? Does it sort of change their day?
Yeah, it does. They're both really upset about it. They love playing outside. And I think one of the things that, some of the feedback that I've gotten that parents maybe that don't agree say that, you know, take your kid outside after school. Why do they have to be
right? I got
in
that
school?
Back too. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think the thing is, there's a couple of pieces of that. The first thing is all kids need to learn how to love being outside, because it's such a natural way for them to learn how to manage their emotions, learn how to work with other kids and cooperate. And then just to be healthy, to have fun running around is so important. And they learn that in school. It should be part of what they're learning in school. And so when we're cutting that, we're really cutting that part of their learning off. And we're saying more of when you need to sit down and you need to be in a seat in order to really learn stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think that's the wrong attitude to take. So also I've seen parents come back and say, you know, my kid has ADHD and they really need more activity in order to settle down and learn. And so what we're seeing is when we cut recess, the kids that struggle with something like ADHD, instead of naturally managing it, they're having to medicate them a lot more. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the drawbacks for students of all sorts of different populations, I think, are being affected. And I definitely see with my kids when they come home and they have not as much physical activity, they're burnt more. They're not ready to, it's like they just want to come home and just kind of sit on the couch for a little bit. They want their brains to shut off. And so, but when they have more physical activity, they can really process the information that we've downloaded to them.
Yeah, well, you brought up a lot of good topics there. Let me pick up on one, which is that recess time at school is qualitatively different from playing in the backyard at home, where you may not even have siblings. You might just be out there by yourself as a kid, or at most with a couple of other kids. And society's no longer the way it was when I was a kid, when kids were able to run around in the street and you had a crowd of kids that would meet up and do stuff together. Very sadly, that doesn't exist anymore. I think because parents are way overprotective. Nothing really ever happened. Everybody was fine, right?
Right.
But we don't do that anymore.
Right.
So now you've got kids who you're trying to kick them out in the backyard, and to do what? Just be by themselves, you know? So naturally they want to stay in on a screen. Whereas at school, you've still got that thing with a huge crowd of kids. And so there's a lot that can happen in terms of learning about outdoors and also learning about how to deal with other people.
Yeah, definitely. And learning just how to have fun with each other and play with each other. And that's such an important component, I think, of being being a person, is to how to have fun. So,
you know, how to have fun and how to work with your peers in a group that's not supervised.
Right.
Because every other second of their day is supervised, and somebody's telling them what to do.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
And that unstructured opportunity in the yard is where they could learn to be a leader.
Yeah, it's huge, and they learn to they use creativity, and when they're not supervised, so they learn to make up games on their own and mm-hmm. make up games with their friends, and so there's all sorts of stuff that they're learning when they're playing outside.
Yeah, I'm really alarmed to see that kind of time going away, and thinking about. Generations, a generation growing up that's more, on screens and more in totally structured time all the time, and what that sort of how we'll grow different people.
Yeah, definitely. And exercise is the number one way for people to fight depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. And as we see that increase, I think that is a direct result of getting less physical activity.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in their short days, of course, if you don't right. get outside when you're at school, you're probably not going to see the sun.
Right.
So the school district obviously is not opposed to recess.
Right.
I think they would love to give more recess if they could.
Sure.
Give me a little bit of their point of view.
Yeah. So the school district, the administrators feel like, so the issue is, and I think you talked about this in your article, that kids in Alaska are not keeping up with proficiency. 40% of the kids are reading below their grade level.
Right.
And so that's definitely an issue. And so the school district wants the kids to be in the class more. And I understand that. And that seems like that might be the right way to go. And teachers, of course, are feeling very pressured. They're getting lots and lots of pressure with their time. They're being told more and more. Their time is structured more and more for how they should be teaching, and less and less sort of given the flexibility to do what they think is right for their kids at that moment. So the school district has imposed a new curriculum, and the curriculum requires that they do a 90-minute block of reading and a 40-minute block of math and a 40-minute block of English study or something. It's like 90-40-40. And so that really ties teachers' hands for how much time that they can have. And the school district sees that as important because then they're getting more classroom time. I would say my pushback to that is that just because you're sitting in a chair doesn't mean you're learning something. And so what I think we really need to look at with the length of the school day that we have is how to be most efficient. And so we need to give the kids the information they need, and then we need to get them to process it so they learn it. And there are tons of studies out there that say that physical activity and exercise promotes learning. And so if what we're trying to do is increase reading scores, what we need to really be doing is not cutting recess, but including more recess and more physical activity time. Because then the blood flow goes from the legs where the kids are sitting all day, and it goes up to their brain, which is where we want the blood flow to be so that they absorb the information that they're getting.
Yeah. And we don't have the school district here today to sort of give another point of view on it. But I think that what I picked up from talking to the superintendent is they want the teachers to have recess. They want to have physical activity in the classroom. And but that they have sort of set this minimum of 45 minutes in the middle of the day for lunch and recess.
Right.
That the individual building administrator, the principal, can determine how that's cut up, or could increase it based on what that school determines. And, you know, to some extent, having school governance at the school level is good. You know, parents could get together, and if they could convince the principal to increase it, they could. I personally think the school day could be longer. And you could have more, I think have morning and afternoon recess too.
Yeah, definitely. That is definitely the best way to go. The more breaks we can give mm-hmm. our kids with physical activity, the better they're going to absorb everything we want them to learn. So I do think the day could be longer so we could give them more of that. But with the day that we have, even without it being longer, mm-hmm. I feel like we can do a better job of being more efficient with the time that we have.
So we will have a link to Great Alaska Schools Anchorage on our website at outdoorsexplorer.org if folks want to get in touch with Carrie to talk about that issue. My name is Charles Woolforth. My guest is Carrie Carpenter. She's working on this recess issue with her two kids. And then, Carrie, you also started a group called Anchorage Young Cancer Coalition. And that also has an outdoor component.
Yeah.
And it also really has something to do with our theme of of personal growth. How did that come about? What is it exactly?
Yeah. So 7 years ago, I was diagnosed with cancer. I was diagnosed with an aggressive breast cancer. And I went through treatment.
What age were you when that happened?
I was 34.
Uh-huh.
And my kids at that age, my kids were 1 and 3 when I was diagnosed. Mm. And so I went through 15 months, a little more than a year of treatment. And as I was going through treatment, I realized that most of the people that I saw around me were not my age. But I did know that sometimes I would see other people that were my age and in a similar life circumstance as I was. And when we would see each other, it was like a breath of fresh air. We would just say, oh my gosh, you know, how do you go through cancer treatment? How do you do chemotherapy when you have a 1-year-old?
Right.
And so I decided that after I was done with treatment, I would give back and try and connect people that were in that similar circumstance. And so I started the Anchorage Young Cancer Coalition, which is for young adults. And we meet up and talk about, sometimes we talk about cancer and sometimes we just talk about what's going on in the neighborhood. So it's very organic, but it's all based on emotional support. And we do a lot of physical support too, where getting outside and after you've been diagnosed with cancer or after you've gone through treatment just can replace so much of what I feel like cancer takes from you. And so you want to...
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So physically, when you go through treatment, there's all sorts of side effects that happen and you're on all these different kinds of medications that zap your energy and zap your strength. Mm-hmm. And to be able to get outside and regain all of that and get that strength back and feel like you can reclaim sort of what your body is, that it's huge. It's huge for physically, but also emotionally and mentally being able to come back.
That's such a good point because cancer really does rob you of your autonomy in a big way, right? You're suddenly going to all these appointments and you've got this horrible stuff being put in your body and you can't, you've lost control on top of everything else, on top of all the fear and the illness. You've lost sort of this sense of yourself as an autonomous being in some way.
Yeah, definitely. And so so the group kind of, I see it as gives back to ourselves and to each other in order to kind of build ourselves back up to how we were before.
So what kind of outdoor stuff do you do?
Yeah, so I want to, the Alaska Run for Women has been a great support for our group, and they have given us grants so that we can go out and do group activities where we've done a float trip down from Spencer Glacier. And so it allows people to just get outside and enjoy nature and do some nature bathing, you know, and in the fresh air in our beautiful Alaska wilderness and give back to our souls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how many people do this? I mean, how many people are involved?
Yeah. So on my, we have a private Facebook page. Mm-hmm. And so we have people that can join us there if they're not maybe ready to, if they're in treatment and they don't have the energy to come out. But on our Facebook page, we have over 130 people. And then we have an email group that has about that same number. And so, but we don't have that many people attending all of our meetups. People kind of come and go as they sort of need the support.
Do you organize it through meetup.com?
That is one of the places. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's one of the places that we list our meetups. And then we also, we put them as events on our Facebook page. Mm-hmm. And then I send out a monthly newsletter to everybody that I have emails for and to all the doctors and providers and stuff.
We'll make sure we have your webpage so people can get in touch with you on outdoorexplorer.org and so they can get involved. I'm interested in your own experience, Carrie. After you went through this cancer experience, you were already a runner, right?
Yeah.
And pretty avid outdoors person, as so many of us are. Did you find like you had to rebuild from scratch and just get back to where you were? Did you ever get back to where you were?
Yeah, that's a great question. I definitely had to rebuild from scratch to get back up. And it was hard, but I was ready. When I was done with treatment, I was kind of ready to be like,
sick of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I am. I'm sick of the doctor's appointments. I'm sick of feeling sick. I just kind of want to get out there and enjoy being outside. And so, but I was not, and I'm still struggle with it a little bit, that I keep trying to get back to where I was before, but I can't get back there. I'm maybe 85% of where I was physically before. Mm-hmm. Now my body requires a lot more sleep.
You're older.
I'm older. And so, yes, I kind of think the adjustment to that has definitely been, the mental adjustment to what I can expect has been harder.
That would be hard. And I would think it'd also be hard when you're just coming right off of cancer to realize that you've got to build slowly and it's going to take a long time, and some of the treatments can really make it hard for you to even return to a workout, right?
I mean, it's definitely.
You've got to really want it.
Yeah, patience is definitely the number one thing I think you need to have. But at the same time, coming off of cancer treatment, you feel very like, oh, I'm so glad to be here, and I feel so appreciative to be able to, you know, get outside and do all these wonderful things. But and then you kind of balance that with, but I really wish I could run as fast as I was able to before. And so it's, you know, it's kind of tricky with, I would say, both of those things. So it is hard to get back into it, but you come back with a greater appreciation for what you have and just the ability to be outside and thankful for, you know, being able to see the sunset and that kind of thing.
And I think some people try to put it completely behind them and like sort of pretend that it never happened, but it sounds like you've sort of embraced that this is part of your life and you're trying to help others.
Yeah.
And sort of like, this is who you are now.
Yeah.
Has that been do you think that for you that's a more therapeutic way to do it?
Yeah, I think it's very therapeutic. I think my being able to meet people from all different like walks of life that I would not have met except for this group is, I love that. It's fascinating to me. I love getting to know new people. And being able, for me, really being able to give back to other people, it's a tough road to walk. And so,
absolutely.
Yeah, so to not have to walk it by yourself, and there's a lot of questions. The doctors do a great job about treating the cancer, about trying to, you know, kill the cancer and make sure that it's not going to kill us. But at the same time, who do you talk to when you say, you know, is this what it feels like when your hair falls out? Is that normal? And those are things that can only come from people who have been through it before.
Yeah. And when you had the cancer, I'm sure you had to just stop everything, right? Focus on that.
Yep, definitely. It was definitely, I was definitely struggling with just kind of basic living maintenance. And then I had my two little kids, of course, that I was trying to, you know, raise at the same time. So
wow.
It was a
struggle.
Challenge. Yeah.
What a struggle. Well, hopefully you'll never go through anything as hard as that again. Huh?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. That's the hope for sure.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Carrie. This has been interesting, and I'm glad we got to talk about both topics.
Yeah.
Yeah. Carrie Carpenter is the Anchorage Young Cancer Coalition. And she's been working on this RECESS issue not with a formal group, but sort of affiliated with Great Alaska Schools Anchorage. We'll have links to all that, and you can get in touch with Carrie if you want to. Thanks for coming in, Carrie.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Stay with us. Outdoor Explorer will continue.
There's a mountain of statistics that say Black Americans don't go out in nature as much as other ethnicities. I mean, it's something that I can believe because I kind of live it and I fit into the statistic. I'm Black and I kind of like nature, but I don't really mess with it in a traditional sense. And I know I'm not alone in that. I'm here in Joaquin Miller Park in Oakland, California with Rue Mapp, the founder and CEO of Outdoor Afro.
Outdoor Afro is an online and in-person social and nature network. And it's our goal to celebrate and inspire African-American connections to nature.
I took a hike with Rue and other hikers on a Sunday morning, and I asked them about what they think of Black folks and nature not mingling much.
I think a lot of times, a lot of Black people, like for me, we're originally from Chicago and we lived in a very concentrated area, cement city really. So in the city, we just knew city life and city stuff, but we didn't know like outdoorsy stuff. But once you move away from the environment, then you can do outdoorsy stuff.
That's Kush Anderson. She and her son Jermaine traveled from Sacramento to participate in today's hike. Then there was Krishna Jude Moore. So I asked Jude Moore if he was familiar with any Black American contributions to the environmental movement.
It was a Black man who came up with peanut butter, and everybody I know who goes camping, I mean, you got to have peanut butter.
Moore's talking about George Washington Carver, and he's not just the inventor of peanut butter, but he's one of the most prominent agriculturalists and inventors of the 1800s. These contributions that we tend to forget about are what RUMAP thinks is part of a rich history of outdoor exploration and environmentalism that Black Americans have been part of. Our group leader, RUMAP, breaks it down for us.
So much of our history there, and so that one of the things that Outdoor Afro aims to do is to break open not only the natural history of a place, but the human history of a place. And in that way, we're able to help people feel a deeper sense of connection, purpose, as well as a sense of ownership. Like, this is mine. You know, these are where my people dwelt.
History is a big part of these walks for RUMAP. She told me about the Buffalo Soldiers. The Buffalo Soldiers, they were an all-Black military unit that later became some of America's first park rangers. But the Black tradition of outdoor contributions goes beyond the Buffalo Soldiers. There's also individuals like John Francis. He's a Black man who grew up in Marin County, and he walked across America to promote environmentalism back in the 70s. To learn more about some of these Black environmentalists, I met up with Carolyn Finney. She's the author of Black Faces, White Spaces, and she's a professor of environmental policy and management at UC Berkeley.
In terms of the majority culture, historically in the United States, setting a narrative and a tone about the environment and the way we should think about it and relate to it, we Black and brown folks have largely been left out of that mainstream conversation.
So Finney says being left out takes a couple different forms. One of those is representation in environmental and government organizations, where people of color represent somewhere between 12 and 16%, while we make up nearly 40% of the U.S. population. Then there's the media's representation of Black folks in nature. Dr. Finney looked into this. She picked up a decade's worth of issues of Outside Magazine. That's one of the most popular outdoor enthusiast magazines around. In it, of the 4,600 photos that had people in them, just over 100 featured Black Americans. And those are mostly famous male athletes. Doing my own little experiment, I checked out the latest edition of Outside Magazine.
Nah. Hey, there's a familiar face. There's a brother right there. There's one. Nah.
In the latest edition of Outside, out of the 87 photos that have people in them, only 8 feature Black Americans. But representation isn't just about jobs and the images in magazines. It's about the larger narrative we create about the environment and the outdoors. Black people do get outside, just not in the traditional ways that we tend to think about the outdoors. Some people get their outdoor activities by hitting a hiking trail, while others might just kick it over to Lake Merritt for a barbecue. It all doesn't have to look the same. Again, here's RUMAP from Outdoor Afro.
People tell me all the time, well, Black people don't have a relationship with wild spaces. But when I start talking about fishing, for instance, ears perk up and the stories unfold.
Some of those stories are part of a history when coming together in public spaces wasn't always safe for Black folks. And that legacy of not having safety in numbers has led to a particular way of thinking about nature. When the Outdoor Foundation surveyed Americans and asked why they don't take advantage of nature, more than a third of Black Americans said they're just not interested.
Nature has a PR problem. For generations, people have worked really hard on farms. The idea of going out and sleeping on the ground is not appealing. It doesn't signal progress to some people. I've actually have heard some people say, why are you going to play homeless?
Well, in my experience on the hike, with the birds, the smells, the views, the tranquility, it felt really good to be outdoors. I might even start to switch my walks around Lake Merritt in Oakland for more hikes in the hills. In Oakland, I'm Todd Whitney for Cross Currents.
And that was Todd Whitney from KALW in San Francisco. Earlier in today's show, we heard from Adrian Lindholm, whose new book is called It Happened Like This, and from Carrie Carpenter. She's the founder of the Young Anchorage Cancer Coalition. Our producer and outdoor explorer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.